Welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution on PodClips. This podcast is designed to offer valuable perspectives and insights to individuals engaged in the mediation process. Listeners will benefit from the experience of the profession's most accomplished mediators who share compelling stories of conflict and the lessons they have learned from handling challenging and intriguing disputes. Throughout the episodes, you will hear firsthand accounts of how conflict has impacted the lives of those involved and discover how mediation enables individuals to move forward free from the burden of ongoing disputes. The discussions on this podcast provide practical guidance on addressing and overcoming difficult issues, helping listeners achieve more satisfying outcome in mediation. Whether you're a mediator, an attorney, or someone who has participated or is considering participating in mediation, you'll find actionable advice and encouragement. Your host, Len Levy, is a mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading provider of alternative dispute resolution. Len brings extensive experience, having litigated complex cases for over 30 years before transitioning to mediation in 1998, and has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. Len Levy's expertise and dedication set the stage for insightful conversations and meaningful learning for all listeners. And now, your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Season 6 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast designed to add tools to your mediation toolbox. We are brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. In each podcast, you have been hearing a story about conflict, the impact it had on the lives of those involved, how resolution was achieved, and the lessons learned from both the conflict and its resolution. Many of the details of the story you will hear may be altered to maintain the essential confidentiality of mediation while still capturing the core of the conflict and its resolution. Today, we will be discussing something that our guest has entitled The Guru Squatter, and a very intriguing title. And joining me today is, she's a guest, but she's a regular on this show. Always welcome, always with a good story, always with great insights. And I'm talking about Phyllis Chang. Phyllis, for those of you who are not familiar with, Phyllis has excelled at every stage of her career. And for nearly 7 years, she was director of the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, the DFEH, which is the largest state civil rights agency in the United States. As director, Phyllis oversaw 6- and 7-figure settlements, including the largest settlements in DFEH history. She was also senior appellate court attorney, a deputy attorney general with the Civil Rights Enforcement Section of the California Department of Justice, a partner with DLA Piper's employment practice, and two-term commissioner and vice chair of the Fair Employment and Housing Commission. I could keep going, and I'm going to go a little bit longer, but just to tell you, Phyllis is a fellow of the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers, which honors leading lawyers nationwide in the practice of labor and employment law. Phyllis has educated practitioners with her knowledge of the employment law field, wage and hour, employment, civil rights. Phyllis does it all and is an excellent mediator. Phyllis has a practice that is very busy, and there's a reason for that. She is an excellent mediator, and welcome, Phyllis, to Masters of Dispute Resolution one more time.
Thank you, Len. It's always delightful to be on your podcast. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So, we're gonna get right into the Guru Squatter, because there's a heck of a backstory with this one, I imagine. So
yes.
Go ahead, Phyllis.
This is a fatal combination of unintended consequences to a really bizarre business arrangement, in which the daughter of a very rich property owner surreptitiously traded meditation services from her guru and drug counselor for free rent. So this daughter, she was already really not that young, in her 50s. Her father lived overseas, and they owned this huge estate, so large that, you know, I mean, it's hard to believe how large it is. In any event, the father never visited, and here was this empty estate. So the daughter was on meth and had a lot of drug issues. So this guru was also a drug counselor, and she owed him some money. And she said, how about this? You move into this mansion. I'll put you in the basement, which is a huge mansion, still very nice. Rent free. You can move your little boy in as well. And you just give me free drug counseling and meditation services. So he did. So after a while, the woman became drug free. She was fine. She actually got the services she asked for. But her guru continued to live there for 7 years.
Oh, gosh.
So without the drug counseling or meditation services, what did he do? Well, he would sometimes be kind of like a voluntary groundskeeper. He might work on the pool. He might work on the pond where they had 100 gigantic koi fish. And sometimes the daughter would sublet the property for film crews who came to use the big estate for just for filming. And he would help direct traffic and parking and things like that. Unfortunately, he wasn't the best on taking care of the pond. And these koi fish were very expensive, $100 each, and there were 100 of them.
Oh,
and in changing the water, he just put the fish in buckets, and then he said all of them died. The daughter didn't believe him. She believed that he actually went and sold the fish to some big, you know, koi fish company and pocketed the money. So after a while, she did tell her dad that, you know, have a problem. There's this guru who's living for free this past 7 years in your house. He was shocked. The father said he never approved it. He didn't know anything about it. So the father started to evict the guru. And the guru said, oh, no, you can't do that to me. In fact, I'm going to sue you for wages that you owe me for being a property manager for 7 years, and you owe me overtime, and you owe me rest breaks and meal breaks and penalties because you never paid me. I lived there. I worked 24/7. So that's what this case was about.
Oh my gosh. So, you know, it's really amazing what the uninitiated can do to mess up their own lives. It just is. So, okay. So now, was there a lawsuit filed then?
Well, yes, there was a lawsuit filed by the father to evict the guru. Mm-hmm. And there was a counter lawsuit by the guru filed against the father and the daughter for, you know, wage and hour violations, employment violations. So you can imagine how much 7 years of wages would be, especially if there were penalties for rest breaks, meal breaks, overtime. And of course, there was no privity between this guy and the father. The father didn't even know he was there. So then the case came for mediation, and it was, you know, it was very challenging.
Before we get into the mediation, let me see if I understand something here. The daughter came to the realization that I'm not getting some value for what it's not justifying the rent that we're not collecting. And so please get out, or were there words? How did that all come about?
I think it came about when the fish all died.
Ah.
Actually, they're not $100 each. They're $1,000 each. So you can imagine $1,000 each times 100. That's a lot
Yeah.
of fish and a lot of money, and it's
Right.
not easily replaced. So she was probably afraid that some relative or her father would come and then see that the house and the no fish in the pond and this guy living there. And so she thought, well, I have to tell him because he's going to find out. It's better than I just fess up. So when
Okay.
he did, the father is a very, very rich man, one of the richest men in the world. And
Okay.
he lived abroad. So we had a mediation, which, you know, it was the middle of the night for him when he zoomed in to join the mediation.
Was there a representation? I have to assume that there was legal representation for the guru, correct?
Both sides had legal representation.
Okay. And the attitude of the parties going into this mediation, were they near fisticuffs in some way, or what was going on there as far as animosity, levels of animosity? What were you detecting?
Well, I think that there was resentment and some kind of you know, a loss of a trust between the daughter and the father because this is his house, this is his property, and how dare she do any of this without his knowledge? She didn't have the right to sublet, or you know, she could stay there, but not her friend, not a guru, and
Right.
his son.
Okay.
Also, there was a lot of resentment on the part of the father against the guru because he said, you know, hey, I'm a seasoned businessman, and come on, I know you're taking advantage of my daughter and of me.
Okay.
We're not going to pay you live for free for 7 years on this lavish estate with all these grounds, and you haven't paid a penny in rent. All I want you to do is to move out, and you're trying to sue me for $2 million.
Wow.
And then the guru felt, you know what? I might as well sue them because I'm unemployed. And I'm going to have to move off of this really nice property. And the way they're going to make me do it is pay me a lot of money.
So he has nothing to lose. This is a lottery ticket for him.
Totally.
Okay.
Yes, totally a lottery ticket. And he initially demanded, you know, a couple $1 million. But of
Okay.
course, this is a very unusual situation. There's no employment contract. There's no rental or lease contract. So how do you quantify this kind of a case? So
Right.
it took, I think that his counsel just pulled it out of a hat, a couple $1 million. But it was hard for the defendants to kind of put a value on how much it would take to get this guy out of there. So it actually took me quite a lot of research. They needed help. And it's also a very novel thing for any, even as a, for an employment lawyer to delve into. So I looked at the labor code and I said, well, you know, here's some possible ways to quantify this. One is, let's take a look at the role of estate managers. So I looked at estate managers' earnings in Los Angeles County and even some very high, you know, high-paying neighborhoods like, you know, Be Beverly Hills. And we looked at what that would be per year times 7 years, and then looked at the value of the rent if he had to pay rent for living in such a space. So subtracting that, it came out to be about $250,000. The other option to say is to say, well, let's just look at it from the theory of this employee of this guru, because he's saying, no, I was an employee, and then let's look at year by year, the because if you don't specify a rate, then you look at the minimum wage. So the minimum wage changes every year, right? So I looked at the minimum wage for 7 years and looked at the non-exempt salary and then looked at calculated penalties and such and came up with a number that actually was almost the same as the other number for an exempt estate manager, about $250,000.
How you approached this mediation was to go in with some idea of what it would be, and some objective criteria to apply to be able to understand what the risk might be
Yeah,
overall.
that's
Okay.
correct. And it turned out that in both directions, whether you looked at him as an exempt employee, as say an estate manager, or a non-exempt employee entitled to overtime, extra pay for working, no rest breaks, no meal breaks, and then the penalties that built up through all those years, it turned out to be about the same.
Okay, so here's what strikes me as being very strange. First of all, the owner of the property, the father, had no idea this guy was even in existence. The only one who had that knowledge is the guru, the son, who I don't know, I'm picturing a little kid,
A
but
little kid, yes.
okay, and the daughter.
Yes.
But the daughter had no authority to hire someone, and indeed didn't think she had hired someone. The reality for the uninitiated was something. Who was explaining that to her?
Right. They were at a loss as to how to quantify this. What is it worth? Even if he was correct, they didn't agree that he was correct, but you needed to have some theory. You needed to have some way of quantifying so that everybody could see it and understand it. So those were the two ways I thought of. Nobody else came up with any idea other than a number they pulled out from the sky. And so it took a little bit of time, but finally the case settled for a bit more than these calculations.
Okay, so let's take a break. When we get back to continue our discussion, we'll figure out what actually took place at the mediation and how these parties came to a realization of risk, perhaps. So I'm Len Levy. I'm visiting with Phyllis Chang and Phyllis, and I will be back after this break.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California, leveraging technology to drive resolution. ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy. My guest is Phyllis Chang. We are talking about a guru, squatter, who apparently actually thought he had a lottery ticket and may actually have had one. So, Phyllis, you've just described all of the facts that led up to this. Going into the mediation, what is it that the parties could agree on, if anything?
Well, they only agreed that the daughter had initially traded free rent for services. But that didn't last for very long. That ended probably within a year. So the next six and a half years, the guy just got to stay there free of charge. He said, well, I worked. He said, I took care of your pool. I took care of the pond. I took care of the fish. And I was, I directed traffic whenever you had a film crew there. I don't even know if the father realized there were film crews.
I'm trying to understand some risk here for the daughter. The daughter is someone who had gone through drug rehab with the help of this guru, the last year of it being the exchange of services. Is she independently wealthy somehow, or is this all going to be funded by daddy?
All funded by her father. She
Okay.
was not independently, she totally relied on her father for support.
So under these circumstances, it must have been difficult for the father to say to even recognize the possibility that he was an employer, unknowing.
He denied that he was an employer. He denied he gave them authority to live there. And basically, the guy was just a squatter. He just moved on the property without permission. And he had no right to the leasehold whatsoever. But and I'm sure the father was extremely disappointed in his daughter. And maybe there were consequences behind the mediation that we were not aware of. But I think for the daughter, because the father is so extremely wealthy, her risk of not disclosing to him and him finding out would have probably meant a greater risk for her in the long run. So, he may not leave her anything in his will or trust. In this way, he might be angry at her and discipline her. Maybe he would try to control her spending or something, but maybe she wouldn't be cut out of the will.
So the financial motivations that are normally in an employer-employee relationship that's understood to be such was not there. It was the risk for the daughter was what you just described. The risk for the father was he goes into petty cash and pulls out some money. So, what is the driving force behind the father agreeing to fund a settlement?
He certainly didn't want this guy on the property. Who knows what else he was doing on the property? And if the guy was angry at them, there could be damage done to the property. There could be, he could, do any number of things, and get away with it. The risk of having this guy stay on the property was great. Yes, he could possibly evict him, but not. He'd still have to come to the United States. He'd have to go to court. It would be a dragged out fight, and he wouldn't want his name bandied about. It's kind of a family shame. This is a rich Asian businessman, so it would be shameful for the world to know that he had allowed this to happen in his own estate in America. And that he didn't pay attention to this huge investment he had. He never even came to stay there. And then also that he raised a daughter who lied to him. He raised a daughter who was on had been on drugs and had caused all these problems. So a lot of that was also avoiding publicity and just preventing further problems that could arise if this guy were to stay there. And maybe as a way to teach and discipline his own daughter.
That part of it wasn't going to be in part of any settlement agreement,
Oh, not at all. But the daughter was very feeling very bad. She felt very guilty. At the time she entered into this agreement with the guru, she wasn't in her right state of mind. She was on drugs, she was on meth. So she didn't have the best judgment. Now later she realized, oh, that wasn't a good thing to do. But when she found out that if she didn't do something and her father found out, the consequences for her in the long run would be much, much greater. That's when she told her father.
It's very seldom that we find the number of below the line issues driving and motivating parties to engage in a mediation as we're present here. The everything had to do with things other than the actual payment of money, right? So, with that, are all of these things you discovered during talks during the mediation? Or how did you, as the mediator, did you try to sell them on something or just hear what they had to say and see what fit within what their descriptors were?
I had to, of course, understand what was the underlying motivation. I knew that the father was very frustrated and disappointed in his daughter, angry at the guru for taking advantage of her when she was not in her best state of mind, and even more angry that he was now making him pay for her mistake. But on the other hand, he just thought, you know, I need to just solve this problem. I'm a businessman, and I can solve this problem with just paying this guy off and getting him out of her life and their lives forever. Of course, the guru, it was a windfall for him. He lived on this huge estate for 7 years, free of charge. And for the daughter, it was a way for her to show some contrition to her father. And we don't know what happened. That's between the two of them privately. But she's going to have to do a lot of groveling for her father to win his trust, to have him forgive her again. And, you know, time was short. I mean, she's not a young kid, and he wasn't a young man either.
So part of the risk that you uncovered was not just, it's not just wage an hour, how much, the calculations that you did going in. This is the father having, not just being disappointed in his daughter, because he knew about, I take it, the drug usage. Was that, he did not?
He probably didn't know, because she lived in America and he lived in another country. And maybe when she visited him on occasion, she was, you know, she was composed, and she didn't take drugs at those times. So he may not have known she was in all of this trouble in terms of her addiction.
So he pictured it as a taking advantage of his daughter. What I'm hearing too is that the motivations that were driving the dispute became somewhat less important than the opportunity for the daughter to regain some face with the father, and for the father to help his daughter rid herself of this albatross that's hanging around her neck, and perhaps help the relationship, whatever that relationship was, between the father and daughter.
Absolutely. You got it down. Exactly. Those are the underlying motivations. And the father knew that with some money, this guy would go away. And he thought, you know, I'm a businessman. In the great scheme of things, it doesn't matter. This is a loss, but it's also a lesson learned. Right. And honestly, maybe he should have paid more attention to his property. Maybe he should have had a regular professional take care of the property rather than trusting his daughter to do these things. Well, he didn't even pay the bills. He didn't even pay the bills. His wife, who's a stepmother to the daughter, she paid the bills. She also never visited the property. So the people who had the money didn't take any interest in the property.
So you approached them in the mediation. We've been focusing on the motivations of the parties. But at what point in the mediation process did you begin negotiating numbers? Because it seems like that the guru is simply motivated by pay me enough and I go away.
I think that fairly soon in the process, because the father is a businessman, the guru just wanted money. So really that we started on that, but the parties were far apart. You can imagine the father didn't want to pay anything. I mean, this guy got a free rent all these years. So the parties were very far apart. But in order for us to even find out what would be a reasonable meeting point, that's why I looked at the wage orders and did a little investigation. I normally would not do these things for the parties because they have all their own counsel. They know what they're doing. But this was such an unusual situation with no employment contract, undefined roles, somebody living on the property. They needed a little bit more help. And that's why they actually asked me if I could help them. And I did some of this work in advance of the mediation. Counsel had asked me to look into this. So I think it gave it a little bit of context and a little hook and some structure to the negotiations.
These are things that you know to do. And you know to do them because of your background dealing with wage and hour issues, dealing with employment issues, and understanding the process that requires you to choose those tools which will help you help them.
Yes.
So the idea of having conversations before, is that something that you always do,
I
or
always have a pre-mediation conference call with counsel about, you know, the logistic of the mediation, what in terms of briefs, what I want in the briefs. I want them to exchange information, for example, the opening demand from the plaintiff and from the defense. I always ask them to send the other side a settlement agreement template, just so everyone is on the same page. But I also had separate conversations with counsel because of this complicated background. And it was really defendant's counsel who asked, you know, I really don't know how to quantify this. Can you help me out? So I said, all right, I'll look into it. But even for me, it was a very unusual situation. Most of the time, we don't deal with people who lived on properties, right, for 7 years.
right.
Most of the time, in terms of wage orders, you know, if somebody's non-exempt, you know how many they usually work 8 hours a day, or they're supposed to have
Right.
scheduled breaks or time cards. But this is, there's no defined underlying hourly salary. There's no defined, he's always at work, right? He's always on the estate. So, and then the minimum wage for each of those years is different. So it did take a little bit of calculation.
Right.
I was pleased to find out that whichever theory we took, whether exempt or non-exempt, the numbers came out to be about the same. So I thought that that was good guidance.
Well, I will say this. Results like this don't happen by accident at all. I mean, the parties chose the perfect mediator to do this, because there are some who are not capable of doing that. But that is part of your toolbox. And what tools to use is something that you're able to use effectively. Well, we're going to be right back after a word from the American Institute of Mediation, and I'm talking with Phyllis Cheng, and we're going to get into some takeaways on the other side of the break.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution, and we are chatting with Phyllis Cheng, who has been displaying the masterful use of those tools available to a well-prepared mediator. And if this hadn't come clear already, Phyllis Cheng is a well-prepared mediator in all of her mediations. This one required some, let's say, digging deep. So Phyllis, let's kind of get into what some of the takeaways might be from this, and how attorneys could do wage and hour work, certainly can learn from what happened.
Well, I think that this case tells me that when people enter into any kind of agreement, whether it's for a job or whether it's for housing or for business, they really need to consult an attorney in advance rather than just, you know, figuring it out on the sly, because unintended consequences can happen. And if it involves other people's interests, like, oh, this property belongs to somebody else, or it involves maybe some complicated legal disputes down the line, it really is behooves them to take care of it. Also, don't let anything linger. This situation linger for 7 years, and don't hide the ball from the decision makers who can help you resolve the problem. So here, at least we had gone through that. The daughter was finally did the right thing by disclosing the truth to her father. And her father, being a businessman and as angry, I'm sure, as he was with her, he knew what to do, and he wanted to just resolve it. So I think for a mediator, you need to be flexible, and you need to kind of think about, well, what is this case really about? And what kind of remedies are available here? This could have very well been a housing, landlord-tenant issue. This could have been an employment issue. It could have been a breach of contract issue. It could have been any number of things. But given that the plaintiff himself came up with the idea that he was an employee, we went in the direction of employment. And so that was how we resolved this case. But it could have gone in any number of directions.
Well, the attorney that the plaintiff had, was he or she a specialist in employment law and wage and hour law?
The plaintiff's attorney, I would say, had passing knowledge of yeah. employment law, wage and hour law. And then I would say that the father's lawyer was more of a landlord-tenant lawyer.
Okay.
So they came from slightly different places.
The expression, for a man with a hammer, every problem is a nail. And so sometimes when people go to an employment lawyer, they'll go, okay, this is an employment case. I could handle this. Go to a landlord-tenant lawyer. Oh, yeah, this is really, this is a landlord-tenant case. But it sounds like the lawyer for the plaintiff had more of a general background, and so was able to perhaps think a little bit more outside the box than that.
Yes, and he knew that he had advantage because the father had been lied to, and so he was, angry, and he wanted the situation to end. And the father had a lot of money. Everyone knew how much he was. I mean, he's written up in magazines and things like that. So right. He knew that this defendant can pay.
Right, right. So the idea of reaching a resolution along the lines that the resolution did occur, it sounds to me like it's purely your application of how can we approach this from a resolution standpoint, whereas the attorneys look at it from perhaps a little bit more from an advocacy standpoint. That's their role. They're going to advocate for their client within the bounds for effective mediation advocacy, as an advocate with the idea of convincing the other side that there might be risk, as opposed to making the argument in front of the jury.
That's correct. That's correct. I think that the defense attorney was really at a loss as to how do you settle a case like that, and what theory can we rely on for us to even argue on behalf of my client.
Right.
And on the other side, they were going to use any way they can move forward. But I get the sense that plaintiff's counsel maybe has worked on a couple of wage and hour cases. So he went with this.
Got it. I've mediated a couple of wage and hour cases involving managers of motels and things of that nature. And the idea of, wait a minute, there's a married manager and his wife is doing this too. And how many employees are there here? And what is that arrangement? These are all things that for the uninitiated, so to speak, employer, consult with an attorney. That's a huge takeaway from this. Now, the idea of having someone living in this property that you can't get rid of, there are a lot of horror stories. I mean, I think I saw one just came up in the news where somebody had an Airbnb and the like, and at the end of the month, the person just said, "No, I'm staying.
Well, you know, it's those old English cases about adverse possession, right? Even though he didn't own the property, he could certainly claim he had an adverse possession theory for a leasehold, that he could live there forever and that they allowed him to live there for 7 years, you know, that's his expectation.
Well, you know, the other thing that's really kind of interesting is if the father did not know that his daughter was a drug addict, the idea of resolving this case seems even more daunting, because what he has to do is he has to forgive his daughter for making a lousy business decision, and without knowing the fact that if she was borderline competent to even make the original arrangement.
Yeah, I think she was not in her right mind at the time she made the arrangement. And later on, she just was kind of laissez-faire about it and felt, well, you know, let's not ruffle the feathers. I'll just give him a few little jobs to do. He'd run to Home Depot and buy some, you know, light bulbs or screws or whatever, and she gave him her credit card and he charged it, and he would, you know, he said, "Oh, you don't have to pay for the pool, man. I'll take care of the pool. I'll do the chemicals." When they lost all those fish, that's when she suspected that, you know, he had sold the fish for $1,000 each, and it's something that she cannot replenish easily, and clearly somebody would notice all these fish were gone.
Right. Also trying to figure out, when they bought this estate with no intention of residing there or apparently even visiting it, usually you have an estate, people who have such estates, if they're going to have fish and things of that nature, they're going to have somebody who is going to be taking care of things like that.
They had bought the land. They had built this gigantic mansion. I mean, it's huge. It's got a sunroom, it's got pools, it's got, you know, ballrooms. It's just gigantic. And the idea was that the family would visit and maybe they could have family reunions there. But one thing after another, I guess they just never used it. The house took a long time to build. It was built, but somehow the whole idea of using it for the family fell by the wayside, and there it stood. So the father said to the daughter, "Well, you know what, just kind of take a look at it." They had groundskeepers, they had pool people, they had gardeners, they had, you know, people who came and worked on the house. And all she needed to do was to make sure everything was okay. And if there were bills to be paid, she'd tell the father, the stepmother would pay the bill. So nobody knew what was happening.
Wow. Well, to help the parties resolve a case where there's hide the ball on both sides, this is very unusual, and it's really commendable that you were able to come up with a means by which to approach this. I mean, as mediators, look, we get factual situations all the time. Some mediators will look at it from what I refer to as a mandatory settlement conference model, which is, here are the facts. If I'm presented with these facts, this is how I decide the case. But I don't look at that as mediation. I look at that as maybe the imposition of a settlement or something that is used as mediation very often. It doesn't require using the tools, I mean, that you've just described.
Yeah, they asked me for the tool. Normally, the council would have their own theories. They do their own research. They have, you know, their own ways of calculating risk. But here, they needed the assistance. They asked for it. So that's why I went and did it. And I thought, well, let's approach it from two different ways to see whether it's a huge difference. Sometimes the outcomes can be vastly different. But I was really happy to see that the outcome was about the same either way. It does show a little bit of wisdom by wage board to have come up with these theories. Because when you look at these wage orders, you think, oh, you know, they're so complicated. I wonder how they came up with this. But when I actually used it and tried different ways, different theories under the same facts, I was very heartened to see that it came up to be about the same.
Right.
So there's a lot of wisdom in these wage orders.
Right, right. There's a lot of wisdom, too, in the attorneys trusting you and actually asking for your assistance in resolving this.
Yes.
Because this is one of those kinds of cases where you say, if this goes to trial, wow. You talk about tossing the coin in terms of how this would turn out. Wow. It's quite an amazing case. I thank you for sharing it. I appreciate your being able to share it with us and hope you'll be back as a guest once again. But as we wrap up, how can the listeners best get in contact with you, Phyllis?
Contact my case manager, Hayward@ADRServices.com.
And thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. And I'm your host, Len Levy. And this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs, Inc. I hope you'll continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.